Incredible work by Nick Redfern in his latest work, Flying Saucers from the Kremlin. He's next, and you'll join us later on Coast to Coast AM. And we are back with ufologist, cryptozoologist Nick Redfern, the author of so many books on UFOs, cryptozoology, the paranormal, conspiracy theories. And he writes regularly for magazines and has uncovered thousands of pages of previously classified Royal Air Force, Air Ministry, and Ministry of Defense files on UFOs. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. Nick, always a pleasure. How are you, sir?
Hey, George. I'm good, thanks.
You've been traveling a lot.
Yeah, quite a bit of lectures and conferences and a lot of research as well.
Good for you. This book is a home run, Flying Saucers from the Kremlin. Tell me how long it took for you to do that research.
It's probably altogether sort of 18 months to about 2 years. And a lot of it was sort of getting material through the Freedom of Information Act of several nations like Australia, the UK, and of course the United States. And really putting together a sort of fascinating story that hasn't sort of really been told before now, namely the means and which ways which the Soviet Union attempted to sort of create hysteria and paranoia in the United States by fabricating UFO stories. It's sort of a very strange but fascinating lesser-known aspect of the whole UFO phenomenon.
How did the subject matter get to you, Nick, to the point where you wrote a book on it?
Well, actually, kind of ironically, it came from the U.S. government itself. The National Security Agency, like a lot of U.S. government agencies, have over the years collected information on UFOs, and some of those files have been released under the terms of the Freedom of Information Act. One particular file that was declassified by the NSA references an alleged UFO crash just off the coast of Norway in 1952. And somebody in the NSA had actually circled around that story in big letters, written the letters plant, P-L-A-N-T, plant. And it was clear that this particular document was pointing out that this story of a crashed UFO just off the coast of Norway was a bogus story. And it turns out that the Soviets had actually, if you like, concocted this particular story as a means to try and convince the United States that Russia had acquired alien technology, and, you know, they would be firing ahead of us. So, in other words, it was a strange story that I stumbled on and which demonstrated how some of these early UFO stories were bogus. They've been created by the Soviet Union as a means to try and, as I said, create paranoia, fear, and worries that, you know, they were going to fabricate alien technology before we could understand it. And so the more I looked into these stories, the more I found that there were numerous cases where the Soviets had been sort of meddling and getting involved in our politics, in our intelligence communities, and using the UFO subject as a means to do that.
Interesting. And the fact that they would spread these bogus stories, Nick, does not mean that the UFO cases generally were wrong or not real, correct?
Yeah, that's one of the important things I note in the introduction of the book. Just because, you know, the Soviets were creating these bogus stories as a means to create fear and so on, that doesn't take away the fact that, you know, there is a genuine UFO phenomenon. I think all of us, or certainly the vast majority of the people listening right now, you know, do accept that there's a genuine UFO phenomenon. I think, you know, to deny that would be very, very stupid. So, you know, I think what we're looking at, well, I know what we're looking at, is we've got on one side of the coin, we have legitimate UFO encounters. Now, whether the phenomenon is extraterrestrial, multidimensional, time travelers, you know, I admit I don't know, but there's no doubt in my mind that there is a phenomenon. But what essentially happened in the late 40s onward was that the Soviet Union kind of hijacked this genuine real phenomenon and then started to use it for very different reasons. So I think that we need to sort of, look at both sides of the story. One is that, yes, there are legitimate UFO cases, but there are also fabricated cases for very different reasons. And the challenge, if you like, is to try and figure out, which are the true stories and which are part of these counterintelligence disinformation programs put out by the Russians.
The subtitle of your book, Flying Saucers from the Kremlin, very equally important: UFOs, Russian meddling, Soviet spies, and Cold War secrets. And we'll get into each area there. When Roswell hit in 1947, did the Russians get involved in that at all, Nick, in your work?
Well, that's a good question, George, because if you look at the FBI's files, which have been declassified from 1947, and specifically the summer of 47, when the whole UFO phenomenon kicked off in June of that year with Kenneth Arnold, and then just a couple of weeks later with the FBI looking at some of the other cases from the summer of 47. Now, certainly, Roswell is the most famous case, and certainly also the most famous case from 1947 as well. Now, what's particularly interesting is that if you look at the FBI's declassified files, they were also talking in that period, just weeks after the Kenneth Arnold encounter. The FBI was talking to each other about how some of these stories seem to be created stories. As weird as it might sound, when the FBI went to look into some of these cases, they could not find the people. And the reason being, because the stories had been fabricated. And now, we can't obviously place Roswell into that category, but what we do know is that at the height of the summer 1947 encounters, Roswell being the primary one, we do know that the FBI started to look into rumors in that period that there were Soviet spies in New Mexico trying to understand the truth of the UFO phenomenon. So what this demonstrates is that in the immediate aftermath of the Kenneth Arnold encounter in June 47, what we have is a situation where it seems that Russian spies clandestinely were smuggled into the United States and were looking into the UFO phenomenon. And part of that agenda, if you like, was to try and determine what the Soviet Union were doing. And it seems to me there were two things. One was to try and understand the nature of the real phenomenon. Another one was to see how they could put a plan into action, if you like, as a means to create fake stories and really try and mess with the minds of the U.S. government.
Nick, George Adamski was one of the first contactees back in the 1950s, claimed that, he was picked up, that he's been to Venus. Was he involved in this somehow?
Yes, he actually was. I have a couple of chapters in the book about Adamski. Now, for people who aren't sort of overly familiar with the contactee movement, as it was known back in the 1950s, George Adamski, without any doubt whatsoever, he was sort of the primary contactee, namely someone who claimed face-to-face contact with very human-looking aliens, and typically the contactees would meet these alleged aliens out in desert locations such as Arizona, California, New Mexico, and so on. And typically, the aliens would warn the contactees that, if you don't change your warlike ways, then the world is going to be destroyed. And it was almost like a friendly warning, if you like, that most of the stories that the contactees were talking about. Now, George Adamski, without doubt, he was a very controversial figure, but he really does kind of define the ultimate contactee, if you like. Now, lot of people don't realize that in his early lectures, Adamski was talking about how the aliens that he allegedly met out in the California desert were actually communists. Now, that might kind of sound almost laughable to some people, but if you bear in mind that his first book, Flying Saucers Have Landed, in its first printing, it sold just around 125,000 copies, which is an incredible number of books on UFOs to sell, you know, today. You know, the figures are nothing like that at all. And the FBI got concerned because here's this guy talking about how the aliens are communist and how we need to embrace communism. And he's telling essentially 125,000 people that communism is a good thing.
Oh, my God. I bet our government went nuts.
Yeah. Now, if Adamski was just speaking to groups of like 10 or 15 people in a, you know, back room in a library on a Sunday afternoon, I don't think the FBI would have cared at all. But the fact that Adamski, you know, was selling books in such massive amounts and he was, you know, heavily wanted on the lecture circuit, and he's promoting communism, promoting Russia and so on, that's why the FBI got concerned. And one of the things that they found, which was particularly intriguing, that the FBI, in the course of their surveillance of Adamski, they found that on a number of occasions, Adamski had been meeting, apparently, with Russian individuals in downtown Los Angeles in the 1950s. And the story is a very intriguing one, where these meetings would occur on several occasions in 1952 and 1953. And the FBI came around to the idea that the entire goal, if you like, of some of the early contactees was to spread communism, but to do it under the guise of friendly aliens who just want to help us. And another of the early contactees, a man named Orfeo Angelucci, who was sort of like a second tier, if you like, of the contactee movement, he went on record as saying that a group of essentially like Russian individuals met with him on the East Coast prior to a lecture in the early 50s. And he talked about how this particular mysterious group tried to convince him to slant his lectures around communism. And fortunately, Angelucci would not go with that particular theory. And he actually told the FBI, he approached the FBI, and again, a file was opened on him. And to give you an example of the concerns that the FBI had about Adamski.
And was Adamski a plant in any way?
Well, whether or not he was a direct plant is something, you know, we can debate upon. But there's absolutely no doubt that he, in his early lectures, sort of 52 to 55 onward, he spoke extensively about how communism, you know, was the way of the future. He also said that, you know, that a third world war was looming, and that the Russians were going to win, and he said that the sort of Soviet way of life, you know, was the one for the future. Now, this is not just sort of hearsay. This is actually all mentioned in the now declassified FBI files on Adamski, which I've got hold of. And to give you an idea of the depth of the surveillance that went on, Adamski's FBI file is now pushing 500 pages in length.
Wow. And he died in 1965 giving a UFO lecture in Maryland, of all places for him to die.
I think, you know, the most important thing about this was that, yeah, again, you know, whether people buy into the contactee stories or not, because they are very controversial, the fact is a lot of people were listening to Adamski, and that was certainly one of the goals of the Russians, was to try and ensure that the agenda that they were trying to get across was actually getting across.
Sure. They didn't have social media then, and he was getting a lot of newspaper publicity.
He was getting newspaper publicity, magazines, The conference circuit back then, I mean, was again also much bigger than it is today. For example, George Van Tassel, another of the early contactees, put on regular yearly events out at Giant Rock, just outside Landers in California. And at their height, those particular outdoors conferences at Giant Rock had audiences in figures of like 9,000 to 12,000 people.
Wow. I think when you have a couple thousand at contact in the desert, that's huge.
Yeah. Yeah. Never mind 12,000.
Jeez.
So in other words, the word, if you like, was really getting out there in the early years of ufology that A, communism is good, B, the Russians are far in advance of us, and see that the contactees were spreading the word of the aliens. And I think for the most part, the FBI wasn't overly concerned by the real phenomenon of UFOs because that was being investigated by the Air Force. The FBI was deeply concerned, though, that people like Adamski were sort of molding and modeling the mindsets of the general public.
There was a physicist by the name of Howard Robertson back in the 50s, and the CIA put together a panel with him heading it that had a lot of, you know, J. Allen Hynek was on that panel. All of the panelists are dead now. I would have loved to have interviewed them. But you know, this was this called because of the UFO flap over D.C. in 52?
Yeah, it was. Basically, what happened in the summer of 1952, across two weekends, there was a sort of a wave of UFO activity, not just on the East Coast, but actually right over Washington, D.C.
Right over the Capitol, right over the White House, and there was nothing we could do about it.
Yep. Now, of course, if that happened today, you know, there would be uproar, and certainly there was uproar when that happened back in 52, but it was very much, for the most part at least, sort of kept under wraps. The story did break out, but not to the full extent where, you know, the public got to know the whole story. But in the wake of the 1952 encounters, the CIA, which was one of a number of agencies at the time looking into the UFO phenomenon, they established this group, like a think tank type group, called the Robertson Panel. And the agenda was to look into the UFO subject and determine if it posed a threat to national security. Now, various theories were looked at, you know, again, you know, are these U.S. secret weapons? Is it Russian secret weapons? Is it natural but poorly understood natural phenomena? But one of the most intriguing and relevant angles that the Robertson panel looked into was the idea of how the Russians could fabricate, again, UFO events. And the Robertson panel became deeply worried that the Russians could potentially plug emergency phone calls and basically what would happen, the Pentagon, the lines would be jammed by the Russians sort of calling and targeting to try and find ways to clog the airwaves. And that would potentially allow for sort of like a sneak attack, you know, and we would be assuming that it was a UFO attack and so we wouldn't fire back, but it would actually be sort of Russian bombers, that kind of thing.
Hold on, Nick. We're going to hit a break. I want to talk more about this Robertson panel. We'll get into some of the other issues. Nick Redfern with us, his book, Flying Saucers from the Kremlin, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Incredible stories with Nick Redfern as we talk about his work, Flying Saucers from the Kremlin. We'll take calls with Nick next hour here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Nick Redfern with us. Nick, the Howard Robertson panel was put together in 53 after that UFO flap we were just talking about. Who conceived of putting it together and who found Robertson?
Well, basically, George, it was the CIA. They had sort of growing concerns about the whole UFO phenomenon. Clearly, you know, they had a number of hundreds and hundreds of real reports of, you know, strange craft performing all sorts of incredible maneuvers in the skies, not just over the United States, but pretty much all around the world. So the CIA knew that there was a genuine phenomenon, and they created the Robertson Panel, this think tank type group, to, in essence, try and answer the subject, what are UFOs and are they a threat to national security?
To answer it or to debunk it?
Well, actually, it was a little bit of both. It wasn't so much that they were trying to debunk it, but it was a case of trying to demystify it in terms of the general public. That one of the big concerns the Robertson Panel had was that the Russians would find a way to manipulate the phenomenon to sort of terrify the U.S. population. Now, I mentioned before the break as to how one of the big concerns of the Robertson Panel was that the Russians would try and clog emergency communication channels in the United States and do so by basically putting together faked emergency calls. And the lines would be so swamped that the theory was, or the worry was, that the Russians would create this hysterical state and then possibly launch a sneak attack on the U.S. And the other big problem, if you like, that the Robertson Panel had to deal with revolved around H.G. Wells' story, The War of the Worlds. Now, I'm sure many of your listeners will know how in the 1930s, Orson Welles made a radio version of H.G. Wells' novel. And a lot of people who didn't hear the broadcast from the beginning, they turned it on and they thought we were really being invaded.
Oh, they were panicking, Nick. They went nuts.
Yep, there was you know, this panic across the country. And the Robertson Panel were actually very intrigued by that response to Orson Welles' radio version of War of the Worlds. And the Robertson Panel used that as sort of a classic demonstration as to how the public really could be manipulated by something that actually wasn't real in relation to UFOs. And so the Robertson Panel results or conclusions, if you like, were that, yes, the UFO phenomenon was a threat, but the threat was coming from the human angle, if you like, the way it could be manipulated.
What do you think the Russians' goal was to try to, you know, manipulate and meddle in the UFO cases? Was it to affect the public or the government?
Well, actually, it was several things altogether. And this sort of gets to the core of why the Russians were doing this. Now, it's clear, again, from the material that surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act, and particularly by the FBI, one of the big concerns that the government had was that the Russians were trying to make communes, if you like, that it would appeal to the U.S. public, which, you know, obviously didn't happen, thankfully, but that was one of the initial plans, and to do so by using the UFO phenomenon in the way that George Adamski was used and promoted communism as well. But you also had other means and ways as to why the Russians were doing this. And one of the other major issues was that the Russians didn't just target the general public in the U.S., but they also targeted the U.S. government, the military, and the intelligence community. And they did so by sort of seeding, again, bogus stories, but not aimed at the public, but aimed at the government. And the reason why this was done was to try and convince the United States government that the Russians had got their hands on sort of crashed UFOs, dead aliens, and et cetera, and that the Russians were really at the forefront of understanding and replicating that technology. And it turns out that these stories about crashed UFOs from the Russians were totally bogus, but the plan was to try and freak out the Pentagon into thinking, oh my God, you know, the Russians have got their hands on alien technology and we're still using, you know, propeller-driven aircraft. And thankfully, you know, that the rumors, if you like, and the claims as the Russians had this technology eventually fell apart, and the American intelligence realized that they were being duped, And so then we kind of did the same thing to them. We started to then to sort of create our own fabricated stories to try and have the Russians, you know, chasing their own UFO tale, if you like.
The Aetherius Society was a UFO-themed society. Tell us what their involvement was with some of this.
Well, the Aetherius Society is actually still around. Their headquarters is in Los Angeles, and but it goes back to the 1950s. It was a group, a large group of people called the Aetherius Society, created by a man named George King. And it was basically like a large group for like-minded people who have a deep interest in the UFO subject, and particularly from sort of the spiritual side of things. And in the late 1950s, an arm of the British police force called Special Branch opened a large file on the Aetherius Society. Although the headquarters now is in LA, it was actually created in the UK, which is why the British police force were looking into it. And it turns out that the Aetherius Society, not unlike George Adamski, had a large following, and you know, a lot of people listened to them. Now, one of the things that the Aetherius Society were talking about in the late 50s was how the UK should get rid of all of its atomic weapons, and we should try and become friendly with the Russians. And, of course, when that statement was put out and when it was realized that a lot of people were listening to this particular scenario, if you like, British intelligence sat up and took notice. And as I said, it was an investigation was undertaken by the intelligence arm of the British police force, which is called Special Branch. And I was able to get a copy of the entire Aetherius Society file put together by Special Branch. And again, the concern was, had the Aetherius Society been infiltrated, you know, by the Russians? Were the Aetherius Society unwittingly promoting communism, and were they, you know, sort of ensuring in some way that the general public in the UK might actually come around to the idea that, well, perhaps it wouldn't be so bad after all if we did get rid of our atomic weapons? So it's no surprise that the Aetherius Society was watched very closely. But one of the things I particularly talk about in this particular chapter in the book is that every year from 1958 onward, members of the Aetherius Society took part in organized demonstrations against the atomic bomb. It turned out a number of years later that these particular organized events had been infiltrated by the KGB, and there were actually sort of Russian spies, espionage agents in the demonstrations themselves and reporting back as to how successful these organizations and protests were going ahead. So in other words, the Russians had sort of encouraged these demonstrations and were looking for feedback as to how the public in the UK was responding. But what worried Special Branch was that the Aetherius Society had people taking part in these same demonstrations that the KGB had infiltrated. So, again, it's no surprise that you have this sort of joining together, if you like, of politics, of atomic weapons, and of flying saucers, and the Aetherius Society. And again, at the height of the Cold War, it shows how, you know, all of these issues were blended together and became national security issues.
The late Stanton Friedman, of course, was into the Majestic 12 documents. Mm. You've done some work and looked into this, Nick, with the possible connection with Russia.
Yeah, this is probably one of the most controversial aspects of the book. Now, I mentioned at the beginning is, you know, I always try and, you know, legitimize a lot of these stories by using the Freedom of Information Act and, you know, getting hold of files. And one of the files that I did get hold of is a CIA document which talked about how in the 1970s and 1980s, there was deep concern on the part of the CIA and other intelligence agencies that the Russians were trying to target people working in the US who worked for defense contract companies on behalf of the government. And one of the concerns was that the Russians might try and approach people in the United States working in the Defense Department and send who they and just target people who also had an interest in UFOs. So in other words, you might have somebody working in an aircraft company on a classified program, and that person also had a deep interest in UFOs. The concern the CIA had was that some of these people might be approached by the Russians, who would say, hey, you know, if you give us something, we'll give you something. And so the scenario was that the Russians would provide sort of secret documents on UFOs and give them to their contacts in US companies. And in return, the US people, if you like, the personnel, would do likewise and provide their handlers in Russia with UFO documents. And the FBI, the FBI's counterintelligence department specifically, looked very closely into the idea that the Majestic 12 documents were not the real thing, but were creations of the KGB.
Interesting.
And the theory they came up with was that the Russians created the MJ-12 documents and dangled them before people in the US defense programs and said, hey, you know, we'll give you these documents and more if you give us a few secrets about the stealth fighter and the stealth bomber. So, you know, they were trying to essentially turn people in the US into traitors. And this isn't hearsay. This is actually in the declassified files that you know, somebody was in Russia was hanging like a dangling carrot in the face of certain people who worked in the government, and they were trying to, you know, get information from U.S. personnel and use these MJ-12 documents as the lure, but they were just fabricated by the Russians. Now, whether or not that is true or not, the important thing is that that is the conclusion that a significant number of people in the CIA did come to.
How do we know that the Russian meddling into the election wasn't really based on trying to get into Hillary's UFO emails?
Well, you know, I mean, that's an interesting question because, I mean, you know, the more and more we're seeing information coming out now in relation to UFOs, you know, we do realize now that a significant number of people within government do have a deep interest in this subject. I mean, you mentioned Hillary Clinton. We've also got like Senator Harry Reid, you know, who went public and talking about his own knowledge and how he, you know, was able to sort of have some sort of, you know, role, if you like, in getting all this, you know, taking a going ahead and so on. So I think, you know, we're in interesting days right now. You know, we're seeing so much new material coming out almost every day. You know, there's a new revelation in relation to what's going on with the UFO subject and in government as well. And, you know, I think that's something that's growing and growing. I'm not entirely sure that it's, you know, that revelations are right around the corner, you know, and we're going to get full disclosure.
Yeah.
But I do think that, as I said, we're in interesting times when we're seeing all this new material coming out. And who knows, you know, maybe that part of the Russian targeting was to find the UFO programs.
You never know. You never know. Do you think it's ongoing now, meddling?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for example, just a couple of years ago, another set of Majestic 12 documents surfaced, and they're pretty much like the early ones where they talk about crashed UFOs and autopsies of dead aliens and Roswell and things like this. But the documents actually, in one of the documents, a very controversial document, there's this alleged conversation between an alien and a representative of the U.S. government. And throughout this particular document, the alien has very little positive to say about the U.S. government and the U.S. way of life. And it's almost like a propaganda-type document, essentially, you know, knocking down the United States. And it's clear that this document was put together with an agenda at work, with a precise goal at work, and that goal was to make the Russians look good and the United States look bad. If you read the document, there's actually no way you can come to any other conclusion. And those documents only surfaced less than 2 years ago. So, you know, this is very much still going on.
Nick, where do people get your book, Flying Saucers from the Kremlin?
You can get it from Barnes & Noble off the shelves if for people who like to go into bookstores still. Or you can get it off Amazon as well.
And it's published by the Lisa Hagen, the books company, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, they've been with you for how long now?
Yeah, they do good, you know, good design and, you know, sort of nice style and layout. And, you know, I'm always happy with the way, you know, they put those books together.
Interesting. Okay, Nick, and your website is?
NickRedfernFortian.blogspot.com. And you can get me also on Twitter, Nick Redfern UFO.
And we've got that linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Let's come back in just a moment with Nick Redfern, final hour, and we'll take phone calls, questions on many of the things you've heard us talk about, flying saucers. He's also an expert in cryptozoology, so you can chat with him about that too.